Let's begin another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of Ezra, chapter number 3, where we're going to restart our study in verse number 8. We talked about a lot of this already last session, last Friday, but I want us to get it back into our minds for the crisis that then arises. So the situation is this, verse number 8. Now, in the second year after their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, so the second year of their return by the order of Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, is going to be 536 BC. And the second month began right at the tail end of April of that year. So effectively, sometime in May is when this event happened that we're reading about. It says that Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, now he's a descendant of David through Solomon and the line of kings that reigned in Judea until the exile. He is never referred to as king, partly because God put a curse on this particular line, that no one from this line would ever reign as king again. It is interesting to us as New Testament believers that this Zerubbabel is in the genealogy of Matthew for Jesus. But there is a technical loophole as to why Jesus can rule and reign, although he is legally from this line. And here's the loophole. Matthew gives the legal genealogy of Jesus through his adopted father, Joseph. But he doesn't have a drop of blood from this line in his veins. So the curse was not on him. We can go to Luke's gospel and see Jesus' physical line of descent from King David through Nathan, the brother of Solomon. And this is the reason why Jesus has a right to the throne of Israel by blood through Mary and the virgin birth, and by the legal line of descent through his adopted father, Joseph. So Zerubbabel, this man here, is functioning as the political or the government leader. He is effectively the Persians' governor of Judea. And so he is overseeing everything involved in reestablishing the Jewish people in their homeland. He has a partner in this work. His name comes up next. And Yeshua, or Joshua, the son of Jozadak, made a beginning together with the rest of their kinsmen, the priests, the Levites, all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. And we know almost 50,000 came during this first return of the Jewish people, of the ethnic Israeli people, back to Judea. So we got a great big representative sample of the Israelis living in exile. They appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to supervise the work of the house of He Who Is. And Yeshua with his sons and his brothers, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together supervised the workmen in the house of God, along with the sons of Henadad and the Levites, their sons and brothers. So the Levites and the priests are involved in the hands-on construction work because they're working in the footprint of the destroyed first temple. And only the priests and the Levites are supposed to be in that area. But they're assisted by those working with the materials, prepping it, working with the blueprints, by people from the political side of the equation, the Judeans. Now, by this second month of the second year of their return, they are ready to put into place the brand new footprint stones, the foundational stones. More than likely, some of the footprint foundational stones had been damaged in the destruction of the original temple. And so those have to be pried up and gotten out of the way and proper stones put in, because they're going to need to take the weight of all the stones being placed on top of them. And when they lay that new footprint, they have a celebration ceremony. And that's what comes up next. Verse 10. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of He Who Is, the priests in their vestments came forward with trumpets. So here come the priests wearing probably some of those 200 priestly garments that have been brought back with them. And the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord. So they've got the priestly trumpets, they've got the Levitical cymbals, there's probably harps and lyres as well, and hand drums, cymbals. And they came to praise the Lord on this occasion of the refoundation of the temple, according to the directions of David, king of Israel. They sang responsively, so back and forth, praising and giving thanks to He Who Is. And they're using these phrases that are favorites of Israel in their praise sessions going all the way back in their history. For He is good, and His steadfast love, His chesed, His compassion and love and emotional attachment to us. His chesed, His steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. And then all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised He Who Is, because of the foundation of the house of He Who Is was laid. So everybody's really excited and happy, with one slight exception, which is cited here. Many of the priests and the Levites, heads of fathers' households, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping. For the people shouted with a great shout, and the sound was heard far away. So this is a mixed emotion day for some of these people. Some of these people were kids whenever the temple was destroyed. They were probably eyewitnesses, first of the magnificence of the Temple of Solomon before it was destroyed. But some of them, as I said, were kids that were taken away in exile and probably saw the ruins of the temple when they were taken away. And so those guys are upset at seeing this new temple established, because they saw the old temple taken away, and this temple is not going to be anywhere as grand as the previous one. You'll hear me term this as a budget temple. It will still be special, but it is a basic rebuilding of the temple. And we know that because later in Jewish history, in the writings of Josephus, Herod the Great will appeal to the Jewish people of his day to allow him to renovate the Temple of Zerubbabel, because it is not nearly as glorious as it ought to be. It does not live up to the reputation of the God of the universe that it is supposed to represent. And the Jewish people agreed and allowed him to build an even more grand and glorious temple building. So this building of Zerubbabel, very budget, which is sad because of the fact that the people in exile had been instructed through Ezekiel that when they did go back, they were supposed to rebuild a very specific grand and glorious temple complex into which God would move, and there would be great and miraculous things happen thereafter. And so it is my conviction that the Jewish people, not following Ezekiel's instructions from God, missed out on something very special. But that is just in a matter of an opinion from me, and it's worth what you're paying for, okay? But here we know, bittersweet moment, the ones that saw the old temple, they're kind of sad but also excited at the new temple. And all the young ones that have grown up in exile, they're just really overwhelmed with excitement at this idea that they're soon going to have a temple again that is part and parcel of being Jewish people living in the Promised Land. So that was the excitement happening in May. But in the months that follow, something happens. Chapter number 4. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, now these adversaries are termed that because of what they do next. At this point, they're trying to get into some sort of relationship with the Israeli people. These adversaries are the beginnings of what we call the Samaritans, at least one component of the Samaritans. You may remember that long before Judea, the southern kingdom of Judea, went into exile, back in 723 BC, the northern kingdom was taken down by God's judgment at the hands of the Assyrians. The city of Samaria was destroyed, and all the survivors of the northern kingdom of Israel were taken away into Assyrian exile up into the northern countries. And shortly thereafter, those Assyrian kings took non-Israelis and relocated them back into the northern country of Israel. So they were not Israelis, but they found a problem with the land being overrun by wild animals. They thought it was related to the fact that they didn't know how to worship the local gods. Remember, back at this time, many of these people functioned under the idea that gods were regional. And so they appealed to the king of Assyria and said, "You've got to send us some of those priests from the exiled Israelis here to teach us how to worship the local gods." And so he did. Now, the local gods that the northern Israelis were worshiping at that time were the golden calf gods at Bethel and up at Dan. And this was a shameful practice that had been going on for centuries under the Israelis, but that was what was reestablished for these non-Israeli relocatees in the northern kingdom of Israel territory. That's the bunch that we're talking about now. So when those guys heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to He who is the God of Israel, and you've got to remember, the northern kingdom, when they were worshiping those golden calves, insisted that they were worshiping He who is the God of Israel, the God who brought them up out of the land of Egypt and gave them the Promised Land. It was a twisted Jewish faith. And so these new guys, non-Israelis, living in the territories of northern Israel for the past couple of generations, they believe they're worshiping the same God that these returned exiles of Babylon worship. And so when they heard, hey, they're rebuilding the temple down at Jerusalem, they're like, oh, cool. Well, we ought to help them. So verse number 2, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." So all of the history I was just talking about briefly, these guys are convinced they're worshiping the same God that Zerubbabel and Joshua and all of these returnees are trying to build the temple to worship. They're wrong, of course, but they are convinced that they're right. Verse 3, Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the fathers' households in Israel said to them, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God. We alone will build to He who is the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." So the response from Zerubbabel is, no, you don't worship the same God that we are. You guys are not Israelis, and you are not followers of the one true God. And so, no, you may not assist us in building this temple. Now, that feels a little harsh, but it was accurate. And so the people of Samaria, we can call them that, responded very aggressively to that rebuff. It says, then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build. So because they had been insulted, as it were, by Zerubbabel and the others, their attitude changes is, fine, you don't want to let us join you? Then we're going to stop you from getting this temple built. And they bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So these guys get involved in a campaign to stop the rebuilding of the temple almost immediately. And so from 536 BC all the way up to 519 BC, the building of the temple gets suspended. The Judeans don't try all that hard to overcome the obstacles that are put in their way by the Samaritans and by the government bureaucrats that are being bribed by them in the kingdom of Media Persia to keep them from getting the materials or moving them around or getting the building permits, all of that sort of stuff that you know was involved in it. And that probably helps us understand the mindset of the prophet Daniel in the next story that we're going to go to. And that is found in Daniel chapter number 10. So go to Daniel chapter number 10. And this story starts, as it says here, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, which means it starts in 535 BC. So the year after the events we just read about. The year after they started rebuilding the temple at Jerusalem, but then got impeded and gave up. So back in Media Persia, Daniel hears that story. He hears that the returnees are no longer rebuilding the temple. It's going to remain in desolation longer. And that, of course, frustrates Daniel. So in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, so 535 BC, a word was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. The word is true, and it was a great conflict. And he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. So that's the heading to introduce Daniel's own testimony. Here we go, verse 2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. So he is grieving over the latest news coming back to him out of Judea. But the temple is not being rebuilt. Zerubbabel, Joshua, they've given up. They're not even trying anymore. So he goes on a prolonged fast. He says, I ate no delicacies, No meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. Now, we know from the next verse when he probably started this fast. He began it at the very beginning of the first month of the new Jewish year. So we're talking about the spring of 535 BC. And he keeps it up for 21 days until finally he gets to the 24th day of the first month, verse 4. And I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Hiddekel or the Tigris is what we know about it today. And I lifted up my eyes and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. So Daniel, in his 71st year of exile, which means he is definitely in his 90s now, he is probably physically weak from this fast. He continues his grieving and his regular prayer schedule. And he happens to be near the Tigris River, which probably puts him in Susa, more than likely. And then he has a vision. He looks up and he sees a humanoid figure. This is an angel, but it is a humanoid-looking angel. He is dressed with this golden belt around his waist, around his midsection, similar to the vision we see in the book of Revelation. Verse 6, his body, that is the places where his skin shows, was like beryl. Now, beryl is one of the stones used for Middle Eastern skin tone equivalents. So kind of a golden olive skin tone. His face, like the appearance of lightning, so his face seems to be glowing. His eyes like flaming torches, and his arms and his legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, which is again another way that you describe a tanned Middle Eastern skin tone. It's like burnished bronze. This vision does, in fact, sound similar enough to the vision in the book of Revelation of Jesus that some people think that this is, in fact, an early Old Testament vision of Jesus. I am not convinced of that because I think similar language is used for angelic beings in the book of Revelation as well. Verse number 7. I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. For the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they fled to hide themselves. So Daniel is seeing this. He's hearing this because the guy is speaking to him, and the words are rumbling like a great big stadium crowd. There are other people in the room or in the area with Daniel, but they don't see or hear any of this, but they have this sense of dread come over them, so much so that they retreat from where Daniel's at. So he is left all by himself. So I was left alone, and I saw this great vision. No strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. So it sounds almost as if he has an episode of passing out, or at least getting down on the ground because he doesn't have the strength to stand anymore. When I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. And then, behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and feet. So it does sound like he was flat out on the ground, possibly fully in a dead faint, and then he's revived again. And the being, this messenger, helps him up on hands and knees. And then he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I've been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. So now he's back up on his feet again. Then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. And the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. So this being, which I'm going to just tell you, I believe it is an angelic being. I think he might even be Gabriel. This angelic being lets Daniel know, Daniel, from the moment you started fasting and praying back on the fifth day of this month, 21 days ago, I've been trying to get to you. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia, which is another angelic being, not a divine angelic, not a good angelic being, but a fallen angel, the prince of the kingdom of Persia, the regional representative of the fallen angels of this world. He barricaded the entrance of this angelic being from coming to Daniel. And this is the spiritual warfare that we know goes on behind the scenes. But Michael, or Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia, and came to make you understand that what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for days yet to come. So he's barricaded from getting in, and then here comes Michael, the prince of the Jewish people, who's apparently in the same area. This supernatural being, Michael, puts his force in with the force of this being, and together they break him through where he can deliver the message to Daniel, the details of which we will be going over in the next couple of sessions as we get back into God's Word.